Turn with me to Acts chapter 27. We are almost to the end of our study of Acts. One more week next week to finish the text, probably. That could break into two. You never know. We'll see how it goes. But probably one more week to finish up Acts 28. And then 1 week after that for a review of Acts. We don't want to walk away from this book and be forgetful hearers. We want to remember what God has showed us and make sure that we are remembering those things and living those things. So that's all that we have left in Acts, which is fairly amazing. And we'll let you know in the next week or so what we're going to be doing after Acts. I'm not certain, but I have to figure that out pretty quickly. In our study of Acts, we've noted many times that the book ends in Rome. I've said that I don't know how many times. And so our goal, as we've been going through this book, is not just to get to the end of chapter 28, but in another way of looking at it, to get to Rome. That the gospel, which began in Jerusalem and spread out to Judea and then in Samaria, is going out to the ends of the earth, represented by the city of Rome. This was Paul's goal, too. Chapter 19, verse 21, perhaps you'll remember. After Paul would go to Jerusalem, he said, "I must also see Rome." So he was intent on going to Jerusalem to deliver this charitable gift from the other churches to the Christians in Jerusalem. And then after that, he recognized it as something that he strongly desired to do and that God had put on his heart that he must see Rome. This was also Jesus' plan for Paul. Perhaps you'll remember just a few chapters ago in chapter 23, verse 11, when Jesus stood by Paul in prison and encouraged him and said, "As you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome." And so this was something not only that Paul wanted, but that God had planned for him. It would certainly happen. We have two chapters left in Acts. And what's remarkable is that Luke, the author of Acts, only gives 15 of the remaining 75 verses to talk about Paul's ministry in Rome. It's kind of surprising. If we've been trying to get there, why so little about his ministry in Rome? The other 60 verses describe Paul's voyage to Rome. So 60 of the remaining 75 verses tell us how he got there. That means it's obviously important how Paul got there. It was no simple journey getting from Caesarea to Rome. Like so much of Paul's life and ministry, it was hard. There were obstacles. There were reasons to trust God. It was dangerous. And so in response to that danger, there was another opportunity, again here, for God to show his sovereign care. And that's something that Luke has been interested to do throughout this book, is to show God sovereignly caring for his servants as they follow him and witness of Christ. We're given further evidence here in Acts 27 and 28 that we can trust God to care for us as we faithfully serve him. It is important that we are seeking to faithfully serve him, that we are following Jesus, and as we are doing so, we can trust that God will care for us. We finished up with the trials in Jerusalem and Caesarea that took a number of the previous chapters and previous weeks. Now it's time to go to Rome, since Paul had appealed to Caesar. Remember this, that Paul had been tried, he finally appeals to Caesar, and so the Roman procurators, or governors as we would think of them, have now sent him to Rome to stand before Caesar. Pick up with me then, chapter 27, verses 1 and 2. "And when it was decided that we should sail for Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. And embarking in a ship of Adramyttium, which was about to sail to the ports along the coast of Asia, we put to sea, accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica." And so first we see here, this is number one, sailing for Rome. Paul, and we see now the author of this book, mentions that we are doing this. So now Luke is present again with Paul, and we also see Aristarchus all sailing for Rome. So they start out, you might want to consult your map now, start out going north along the coast from Caesarea towards Syria. Syria is up along the coast of the Mediterranean, north of the land of Israel. And then they're going to go west along the coast of what is today Turkey, sailing along the coast, probably using a small coasting vessel and stopping at the various ports along the way, rather than a large ship further out to sea. Then they're going to go west between Greece and Crete. Can you see Crete there, kind of in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea? And then from there, northwest to Italy, and then finally over land to Rome. That would have been the plan originally. And under normal conditions, this trip would have taken around 5 weeks or so. So kind of a lengthy trip, but should have been able to complete it in 5 weeks. Mentioned that Luke is now with Paul. We also find out that Aristarchus is with Paul. Aristarchus has become a traveling companion of Paul. He's also noted as a fellow worker, and we find out a fellow prisoner. He's mentioned back in Acts 19. He's one of the guys that was brought whenever the big riot happened in Ephesus. He's one of the Christians that was brought forward. Then we see in Acts 20 him leaving Ephesus with Paul. He's probably the same Aristarchus that's mentioned in Colossians 4 and Philemon 24. And this is interesting because Paul wrote both of these letters from prison in Rome, probably. And so it seems that Aristarchus was still with Paul when he wrote the letter to the Colossians and the letter to Philemon. And in those passages, we see that Luke was also still with Paul at that time. Now I'll pick up in verse 3. The next day, we put in at Sidon, and Julius, this is that Roman centurion, treated Paul kindly and gave him leave to go to his friends and be cared for. Here's the first of a number of lessons that we're going to see about God's provision and protection of us in these chapters. So letter A, God can give us favor with authorities. As a prisoner setting out on a long journey, God was very gracious to cause the leading officer on this voyage to be kind to Paul. As we go on in chapters 27 and 28, we're going to see just how important this was, that Julius was kind towards Paul. So, if we need this kind of favor from an authority over us in seeking to follow Jesus Christ and serving him, we can trust that God will do this for us as well. This could be at the national level. This should affect how you view elections and how you view elected officials. That God is sovereign over those things, and if we need those kinds of people to be favorably disposed towards us, God is able to do that. Even perhaps at the local level or in your workplace, he can cause your bosses or other coworkers to be kind towards you so that your work in seeking to follow and serve Jesus Christ can go forward. We read of stories like this from people on the mission field, that local officials are very important for the ongoing work that they're engaged in. And we hear about God causing those local officials to be kind towards them. An example that comes to mind is the children's home in Uganda where we are adopting from. They have a very close relationship with the social worker who's over that whole area. And so they're able to have children referred to them to care for. God can do this. We see that they continue on from Sidon. Pick up with me in verse 4. And putting out to sea from there, we sailed under the lee of Cyprus because the winds were against us. And when we had sailed across the open sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra in Lycia. So again, if you have really good eyes, you can kind of pick out where they are on the map. Lycia is a bit bigger because it's a region, so you can see where they are. It tells us that they sailed here under the lee of Cyprus, which means under the island's protection from the wind. That's what that means. They stopped at Myra. Myra is on the coast of, again, modern-day Turkey, across the Mediterranean Sea from Alexandria, Egypt. Alexandria was an important city in the empire. Now pick up in verse 6. At Myra, the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing for Italy and put us on board. The ship being referred to here is probably a large grain ship. Apparently, Egypt supplied much of Rome's grain. And so they got on board this ship. We pick up in verse 7. We sailed slowly for a number of days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus. And as the wind did not allow us to go farther, we sailed under the lee of Crete off Salmon. Coasting along it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens, near which was the city of Lassia. The normal route would have gone north of Crete. Kind of see this on the map, out towards Italy and then to Rome. But the weather, which they had already started to encounter some opposing winds, got worse. And so they are pushed south of Crete, gaining some protection from the wind there, but going where they don't want to be. This is foreshadowing of further trouble to come in this storm that's about to hit them. So it's a difficult voyage. But God's grace is seen already in just getting them this far, getting them to port on the island of Crete here. And also in giving Paul favor with the centurion Julius. Once again, Paul can cause others to be favorably disposed towards us when we need that. And we will see as we go forward how important that was. But that didn't mean that Paul was in charge of what was happening on this voyage. Notice verse 9. Since much time had passed, and the voyage was now dangerous because even the fast was already over, Paul advised them, saying, "Sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives." But the centurion paid more attention to the pilot and to the owner of the ship than to what Paul said. And because the harbor was not suitable to spend the winter in, the majority decided to put out to sea from there, on the chance that somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, facing both southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there. We see letter B, that God can protect us despite the bad decisions of authorities. We know that we're affected by authorities. He can make them kind to us, but we also are subject to their bad decisions. And God can still protect us in the face of those bad decisions. The trip to this point, because of the winds, had taken longer than expected. So they're getting deeper into the fall towards winter. The fast that's referred to here is probably the Day of Atonement, which happened in the fall. And historians have said that year was on October 5th. Much of sea travel would end around that time because traveling in winter was very dangerous. And so by mid-November until February or so, there was no travel in the Mediterranean. And they're getting dangerously close to that. As an experienced traveler, Paul had a feeling, wouldn't say this is necessarily a revelation from God, that continuing on would be unwise, be dangerous both for the property they had in the ship and what was on board, as well as for the lives of the people sailing with them. My wife, Carissa, shared with me recently from a Facebook message, a friend of hers who's married to a guy named Danny Ezel, who with his work was scheduled to be on the Malaysian Airlines flight that got lost. And because of a job change, ended up not being on that flight. Amazing how God is able to care for us in circumstances like that, but Paul couldn't cancel. He was a prisoner. He was at the mercy of Julius's decision. And Julius gave more weight to the advice of the ship's pilot and owner than he did to Paul, which we find was a bad decision. Their take on the situation was that Fair Havens, where they were not a good harbor for wintering. They didn't want to leave the ship there. They wanted to get it somewhere else where they could winter more easily. So there was a better harbor, not very far away, in Phoenix. I don't think that they're, you know, somehow now leaving Europe and traveling down to the southwest part of America. This is not Phoenix, Arizona. This is a Phoenix that we don't specifically know of its location now, but apparently up the coast from Fair Havens, where they could winter more easily and more safely. And when you read this, there's foreboding here, because we, who've read Acts, have come to trust Paul's judgment. And now we see someone who's not trusting Paul's judgment, who's going with the advice of somebody else, and we're thinking, this may turn out bad. We may feel this when other people's decisions affect our lives. When we think, this is obviously the thing that should be done here, but we don't have the power over making that decision. Someone else does. We may feel like probably Paul felt at this time. We need to see God as sovereign even over those decisions that others make, even though they may be unwise, and trust his protection and his purpose in our lives, that God still has a purpose for us even when others are making bad decisions that threaten our lives. We need to be focused more on what is God trying to do in this situation than we are on frustration at what that person should have done or should not have done. Let's see how things turned out, beginning in verse 13. Now when the south wind blew gently, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, they weighed anchor and sailed along Crete, close to the shore. And so they get this encouraging wind from the south, and so they're thinking they made the right decision, still coasting along carefully. But then notice verse 14. But soon a tempestuous wind called the Northeaster struck down from the land. And when the ship was caught and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and were driven along. So now we see, number two, danger on the seas for Paul and all those who were on the boat. This wind is called a Northeaster. It's somewhat personified, kind of like the Nor'easter that we have on the eastern coast of the United States. When converging polar air masses from the north converge with the warmer air masses from the Gulf Stream and cause big weather events and problems for the northeast. In the Mediterranean, these swirling winds are caused when northern and eastern wind currents come together. We call this, or they called it, the Northeaster. This wind is referred to as tempestuous, and the Greek word for this is typhonikos. Does that sound like a word you're familiar with in English? Typhoon. We get that word from this Greek word. So in other words, this was a powerful, dangerous wind that came up against them, and they lost control of the ship. They couldn't control it anymore, so they let the wind drive it along, and now they're not going to end up in Phoenix, but they're going out further into the Mediterranean. And the storm didn't let up. The sailors did all they could to keep the ship together. Notice all that they tried to do beginning in verse 16. Running under the lee of a small island called Cauda, we managed with difficulty to secure the ship's boat. After hoisting it up, they used supports to undergird the ship. Then, fearing that they would run aground on the Syrtis, they lowered the gear, and thus they were driven along. Since we were violently storm-tossed, they began the next day to jettison the cargo. And on the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope of our being saved was at last abandoned. In particular, it says they feared the Syrtis. You can see this on the map, I think, right over top of what's labeled Africa, Syrtis Major. And they feared that the wind would blow them into that area. Syrtis was known as a graveyard for ships. Kind of think of the Bermuda Triangle today. Different reason for being a problem for ships, but similarly feared by sailors. It's off the North African coast of what is now Libya. probably a big problem because of sandbars that shifted around and dangerous shallows that made for tough going for ships. So they pull. The first thing they do is they pull up the small boat, which could be thought of as like perhaps the taxi boat when they would stop in the middle of the sea and then go to land on the boat, or perhaps even a lifeboat. They pulled it up because obviously that would cause problems if it's dragging along in the sea behind you in the middle of a storm. They probably also lashed the boat together to keep the frame intact. That's probably what's meant by the supports used to undergird the ship, using ropes of some sort to pull the frame together. Then they start jettisoning cargo and the gear of the ship to lighten it so that it sails up higher in the waves. And in the middle of all this, they lose sight of the sun and stars, which was the only way that sailors of that day could navigate. And so they're lost, and they lost hope. But we see here, letter A, God can protect us through storms. Things didn't look good, but the ship was still intact, and so far everyone is still alive. So hope was not truly lost, because God himself had given Paul a message. Notice verse 21. Since they had been without food for a long time, Paul stood up among them and said, "Men, you should have listened to me and not have set sail from Crete and incurred this injury and loss. Yet now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night there stood before me an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I worship. And he said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. And behold, God has granted you all those who sail with you. So take heart, men, for I have faith in God that it will be exactly as I have been told. But we must run aground on some island.'" And so we see and learn here that God will give us encouragement in the middle of these storms of life. Paul ministered to the people on board, but only after God had first ministered to him and encouraged him so that he could encourage the others. And don't think that Paul is here rubbing in his earlier prediction. Like, see, I was right. What he's trying to do here probably is to reestablish his credibility. If you'd have listened to me in the first place, it would have gone primarily as I thought it would happen, so now you need to listen to me. And Paul was even more credible, not just because he was a veteran sailor, think of all his mission trips and how much time he had spent out on the Mediterranean, but because now he had a message from God. Wasn't just using his own experience to predict what would happen, but had a specific message from God. God had sent an angel to reassure Paul that he would make it to Rome because he had to testify to Caesar. He also let him know that the rest of the passengers would make it safely. And it's hard, if you're familiar with the story of Jonah, not to think of the similarities and contrasts between the story of Jonah and the story of Paul. In both stories, we have one of God's messengers with a group of sailors, most of whom probably don't know the Lord, in the middle of a storm. But for Jonah, it was because of him that the people were in danger. With Paul, it was because of him that the people on the ship would be safe. Paul was faithfully following his Lord, and so his Lord protected him and the others with him. They would run aground on an island, but there would be no loss of life. God told Paul, "Do not be afraid," so that Paul could tell the rest of the people to take heart, to be encouraged. That's what they all needed at this point. They've lost hope. They've done everything they can. They've lost their bearings. They've lost their hope. And now God is reinstituting hope for them through Paul. And God does this for us too. He might do it through a passage in the scriptures that we read. Might do it through a sermon that we hear. Might do it by a note from a friend, or by a word of testimony from a fellow believer, to give us the encouragement we need to keep on following Jesus Christ and seeking to serve him. When we need fresh courage to keep on following and serving Jesus, he will provide it. And B, or not B, small number two, I guess, he will give us direction. Notice verse 27. When the 14th night had come, as we were being driven across the Adriatic Sea, about midnight the sailors suspected that they were nearing land. So they took a sounding and found 20 fathoms. A little farther on, they took a sounding again and found 15 fathoms. And fearing that we might run on the rocks, they let down four anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. So after 2 weeks, they providentially came near land. They're getting closer, so they throw in the anchors to stop themselves. They're remarkably blessed to be near land, not right out in the middle of the Mediterranean, but notice verse 30. The sailors were seeking to escape from the ship and lowered the ship's boat into the sea under pretense of laying out anchors from the bow. So the others, if these sailors had been able to carry through with their plan, would have just been left out in the Mediterranean or the Adriatic here to die. But God calls Paul to know what was happening. Look at verse 31. But Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, "Unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved." Then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat and let it go. Yet again, God had spared Paul and the others with him, making the centurions and the soldiers in this instance to hear and to heed Paul's word. And Paul had some further advice for them. Pick up in verse 33. As day was about to dawn, Paul urged them all to take some food, saying, "Today is the 14th day that you have continued in suspense and without food, having taken nothing. Therefore, I urge you to take some food. It will give you strength. For not a hair is to perish from the head of any of you." And when he had said these things, he took bread, and giving thanks to God in the presence of all, he broke it and began to eat. Then they all were encouraged and ate some food themselves. We were in all 276 persons in the ship. And when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship, throwing out the wheat into the sea. They hadn't eaten anything. Perhaps they were seeking to ration the food. Probably they had lost their appetite, either because of their fear or just because of being out on a boat and what seasickness does to you. Paul's advice for them was eat something so that you can be strengthened, because tomorrow is going to be a hard day physically. But also for encouragement that comes from getting your belly full rather than continuing on in a famished state. Because they were going to live. There was reason to eat, and soon there would be more food, so they could afford to eat what was there and even to get rid of some of the rest. So they believed him. They threw over some of the rest of the food. What we read here sounds a little bit like communion. Paul took the bread and broke it and gave thanks to God, but it's doubtful that that's what's intended here. There's no wine that's mentioned here. There's no mention of the significance of what was happening. It doesn't say here that Paul then distributed it to all of them. And the audience here is probably mostly, with the exception of Paul and Luke and Aristarchus, unbelievers. So it's doubtful that communion is intended here, but it shows the similarity of the Lord's Supper to the ancient communal meal. This idea of giving thanks to God and breaking bread, and reminds us that when we take communion together, we are enjoying a meal together with our Lord and with each other. But here, it's just that communal meal that seems to be in mind, and Paul is the one who leads them in taking this to encourage their hearts. So God let Paul know what was going to happen and what to do, and then Paul let the others know as well. And then God moved in them to accept Paul's words. And it's hard when you get here not to perceive a parallel with Paul's role as a witness of the gospel of Christ. And it seems like Luke, at least in part, is using the story in chapter 27 and 28 to paint a picture of Paul as a faithful witness and God as protecting him and commending him. They should have listened to Paul in the first place. Now they are listening to Paul because he is a reliable witness. God does the same thing for us. He can protect us. He can cause others. He can cause us to gain credibility with others when we have an important message like the gospel to give to them. But interestingly, we don't read of Paul giving the gospel on this voyage anywhere. I think we can assume that he did because everywhere else we read of him doing that, everywhere he went. But here the focus is on what God did, on God's protection. And one way that he cares for us is by giving us direction. And of course, his word is foundational. In his word, he reveals his character, his will for us. So it's foundational to us. But the indwelling spirit is also vital to take God's word and to show us specific things from it at particular points in our lives to guide us. God specifically, directly guiding us through his spirit. And also, God guides us by his providence over our lives through circumstances that direct us in a certain way. That includes the wise counsel of other believers. God can bring just the right believer into your life with the right counsel that shows you the way to go. So trust God for his direction in times of uncertainty, because in the storms, he will provide that direction for those who are seeking to follow and serve him. God can protect us from shipwreck, even in the face of storms. He also can protect us, letter B, in or through wrecks. God can protect us through wrecks. Let's pick up in verse 39. Now when it was day, they did not recognize the land, but they noticed a bay with a beach on which they planned, if possible, to run the ship ashore. So they cast off the anchors and left them in the sea, at the same time loosening the ropes that tied the rudders. Then hoisting the foresail to the wind, they made for the beach. But striking a reef, they ran the vessel aground, the bow stuck, and remained immovable, and the stern was being broken up by the surf. So their goal is to run the ship up on the beach, but they get stuck on this reef before they make it to shore. This could be like a sandbar, or it could be a reef, or perhaps even the Greek is ambiguous enough to say that it could be some kind of cross current in the waters there that kept the ship from being able to go farther. And so they're stuck, and the waves, these powerful waves from the storm, are just breaking the ship apart. In other words, the ship is about to sink. They can't stay there safely. So this isn't looking good either. After all that's happened to them, there's shore right in front of them, and still it's looking desperate. Now look at verse 42. The soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, lest any should swim away and escape. These soldiers are responsible for the prisoners, and if they escape, the same fate that awaited the prisoners would await the soldiers. And so they thought the way to avoid this is just by killing the prisoners before they can escape. But notice verse 43. The centurion, this is Julius, wishing to save Paul, kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and make for the land, and the rest on planks or on pieces of the ship. And so it was that all were brought safely to land. So once more, God protected Paul and the others along with him through the actions and the decision of a man that God had made favorably disposed towards Paul. He'd made a bad decision before. Now he makes a good decision because God has caused him to be kind towards Paul. God may allow wrecks in our lives, but he can still protect us even when we wreck. It's incredible that they had finally made it to land. They're out in a very large sea. They could have stayed very far out at sea, but God takes that boat and through a storm directs them to land, causing them to wreck right in front of it. And God still does things like this that are hard for natural human minds to believe, that he could take us out of a storm and save us through a wreck. So don't lose hope when the storms in your life have led to wrecks in your life, where it seems like everything's broken apart. Finally, things have come to a screeching, wrecking halt. God still isn't out of options for protecting you. Think of all the various dangers they faced through this time out on the sea and in this wreck, and God protects and delivers them through every single one of them. He doesn't run out of options for providing for you and protecting you. It must have been a great feeling to finally stand on land after all this time out on the sea in a storm, but they weren't totally safe yet either. We see number three, danger on an island. Look at verse 1 of chapter 28. After we were brought safely through, we then learned that the island was called Malta. The native people showed us unusual kindness, for they kindled a fire and welcomed us all because it had begun to rain and was cold. So the people who had survived the wreck, understandably, being in a storm, swimming through the ocean, were cold and in need of shelter, and then it starts to rain. Just seems like things never let up, kind of like the movie where absolutely everything seems to go wrong. But God uses the natives of this island, showing them extraordinary, unusual kindness. Shows us, letter A, that God can use others to provide for our needs. We can assume they help the people get some food as well as getting warm. They could have wrecked on an uninhabited island. And then maybe Swiss Family Robinson Part 1 would have ensued. Or they could have shipwrecked on an island with hostile inhabitants. But God saw to it that they wrecked on an island with inhabitants who were kind to them, who got them warm and got them food. God is able to bring the right people into your life and to work in their hearts to provide for you through them. Again, God doesn't run out of options. He's very resourceful. Not too many weeks ago, Carissa and I learned of a very large donation which had been given towards our adoption from some people that we had never even heard of. Come to find out that they know some of Carissa's family in Ohio, and for whatever reason, God laid it on their hearts to give us a very large donation that essentially took care of the rest of the money that we need for now for the adoption. God can use others that we don't even know to provide for our needs. Hypothermia and hunger weren't the only dangers on this island. Notice verse 3. When Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and put them on the fire, a viper came out because of the heat and fastened on his hand. When the native people saw the creature hanging from his hand, they said to one another, "No doubt this man is a murderer. Though he has escaped from the sea, justice has not allowed him to live." He, however, shook off the creature into the fire and suffered no harm. They were waiting for him to swell up or suddenly fall down dead. But when they had waited a long time and saw no misfortune come to him, they changed their minds and said that he was a god. Letter B, God can protect us supernaturally. Again, doesn't it just seem like things keep getting worse? Finally getting warm, and a viper jumps out of the fire and bites him. Justice may be capitalized for you in verse 4 here, because it could be the name of a goddess, the goddess Justice. This goddess saw to it that even when humans couldn't carry out justice, that she would take care of those who had done wrong things. But their conclusion proved to be wrong. Paul was fine, but not the snake. So some of you are thinking right now of one of your favorite Chuck Norris jokes and what happened when he was bit by, you can call it a king cobra or a rattlesnake or whatever. What's the rest of the joke here? Nate, you want to finish the joke? Or I'll finish it for you, I guess. After several days of excruciating pain, the snake died. Right? It's kind of what happens here. Gets thrown off into the fire. Their next conclusion is wrong as well. Not only was justice not against Paul, Paul was not a god. See their superstition here. And once again, in a subtle way, using kind of a true parable, we could say, Luke is showing us the innocence of Paul and God's servants. I hope you're seeing in this story that it has a specific purpose on the face of it, but it seems like Luke, in spending all this time, is also using it to bring back a lot of the points he's already made throughout the book of Acts. About God's protection of his servants, his giving them credibility with those around them, his showing them to be innocent. Paul is seen to be innocent, but he's not a god. This in itself is an incredible little event. God lets Paul get bit by a viper. But he also keeps Paul from being hurt, using yet one more thing to show his own power and his hand upon Paul. Paul's already survived a storm. He survived a wreck and everybody else with him. And now he survives a snake bite. God's showing through all of this, this is one of his servants that he can protect no matter what happens to him. Even when the last hope for us is a miracle, God can deliver one. He can perform miracles for others' needs to show his power further. Look at verse 7. Now in the neighborhood of that place were lands belonging to the chief man of the island named Publius, who received us and entertained us hospitably for 3 days. It happened that the father of Publius lay sick with fever and dysentery, and Paul visited him and prayed, and putting his hands on him, healed him. And when this had taken place, the rest of the people on the island who had diseases also came and were cured. We see letter C that God can use us to provide for others' needs as he uses them to provide for our needs. Even the chief man on the island was hospitable and gracious towards these people, specifically Paul, Luke, Aristarchus. But he had a need of his own. His father was very sick, probably having what's today known as Maltese fever that could be contracted through drinking goat's milk in that region. And I appreciate the order that Luke sets out here. It tells us that Paul visited the man, that he prayed the man, and then the man was healed. So we see Paul's concern for this man, his dependence on God, and then God's power to heal this man. Paul did have the special power of an apostle, but God still works miracles and can even use us, especially our prayers. So don't stop praying for things that seem impossible to happen. God can do anything. He can deliver us supernaturally. And can deliver others supernaturally. This led to others who were sick coming to Paul for healing. And this reminds us so much of what we read in the Gospels, where Jesus would heal one person and then all of a sudden the whole town comes out. And once again, we're seeing Paul as this model servant of Jesus. And you have to assume that Paul's giving them the gospel. It's been expressed so often in Acts that Luke doesn't even need to point it out here. But the emphasis here is on God's faithfulness, not even on Paul's faithfulness. That's not the main point of this passage. He enabled, he empowered his servant's ministry for him, even in the face of these huge obstacles. It's a privilege to be used by God, even after times of weakness that we've experienced, to take from what God has given us and to help others. It's a great privilege. We need a love for other people, not just to be concerned with our own needs, to be concerned with theirs too. A sensitivity to how God would lead us to minister to those needs. Well, this led to the people there on Malta, the natives, providing for the rest of the journey for Paul and his friends. Paul and his friends would have been responsible to make sure they had everything they needed for the rest of the voyage. That all gets provided for them through these natives on Malta. Notice verse 10. They also honored us greatly, and when we were about to sail, they put on board whatever we needed. So Paul's back on board a ship. verse 11 with me. After 3 months, they wintered there on Malta. We set sail in a ship that had wintered in the island, a ship of Alexandria with the twin gods as a figurehead. And finally, Paul is on the last leg of his journey to Rome. And so here's quickly number 4, arriving at Rome. We see them on another Alexandrian ship. This ship has a figurehead of Castor and Pollux, the twin sons of Zeus and Leda, who were thought to be the gods that protected sailors. So here's another glimpse of the paganism of the people around Paul and his friends. It's ironic with what we've just read because we know it's God who provides safety, not made up lowercase g gods. We see letter A, that God can provide safe conditions. He had provided stormy conditions before, but he also can provide safe conditions. Look at verses 12 and 13. Putting in at Syracuse, we stayed there for 3 days. And from there, we made a circuit and arrived at Rhegium. And after 1 day, a south wind sprang up. And on the second day, we came to Puteoli. It's a different nature to this travelogue from the one that we read in chapter 27. They're making safe, steady progress towards their destination. God is able to provide safety like this for us. Don't let the reality of occasional trials make you ignore God's normal provision of safety. So don't worry about what the next trial is probably going to be. Trust God as you serve him. As he has provided for you and protected you in the past, so he can do again. And he does so much of the time. Don't fail to trust that. Don't fail to thank him for the health and safety that he normally provides. And not all our needs are physical. We also need other people. We need relationships. And so we see letter B, that God can provide encouraging fellowship. Look at verses 14 and 15. There we found brothers and were invited to stay with them for 7 days. And so we came to Rome. And the brothers there, when they heard about us, came as far as the Forum of Appius and 3 taverns to meet us. On seeing them, Paul thanked God and took courage. It's exciting to see here there were already Christians in Italy. We knew this already from the book of Romans, which had been written previously, so there were already Christians in Rome, we know that. But it's exciting to read about it here in Acts. God had already started the work before Paul gets there. And these brothers showed exemplary hospitality. Most of them probably never had met Paul, but they'd heard of him. They loved him because he was a Christian brother. And some brothers all the way from Rome came down a considerable distance down the Appian Way to join Paul and his friends and welcome them back to Rome. And their fellowship was so encouraging that Luke could say, even before they get to Rome, we're there. We've made it. That's how encouraging their fellowship was. And Paul's thankfulness and his encouragement are explicitly stated, which means that at some level, Paul needed courage. Even the great apostle Paul needed courage, and God gave it to him through some fellowship of some brothers from Rome who came down to walk with him back to the city. When you need encouraging fellowship, God provides it. So open yourself up to receive it, and make yourself a willing servant to give it, even when you've got to go out of your way to go several miles down the way to meet a Christian brother or sister and to encourage them on their way. We see one last example of God's provision in verse 16. We see that God can provide favorable conditions for us too. And when we came into Rome, Paul was allowed to stay by himself with the soldier that guarded him. So yes, Paul is under custody. It's not ideal, but he's not under bad conditions. God gave him favor with others, also allowed for these favorable conditions where he could stay in a rented place of his own just had to have a soldier there with him to guard him. We can see what he was able to do with this freedom next week in the rest of chapter 28. He was able to spread the gospel to many throughout the city because of this freedom that God gave him. And so Paul is safely in Rome so he can testify of Jesus Christ there. And what example all of this is for us of God's sovereign care and provision for his servants. As far as I know, none of you is about to set sail somewhere under custody to give defense before an emperor. But the message of today's passage is really for all of us, not just for Paul 2,000 years ago. Whether you're traveling anywhere soon or not, there are dangers in this world in which we seek to serve Jesus Christ. There are threats that result from the poor choices of other people who are set over us. There are threats from natural things like weather and snakes. Other things like that all around us. But God can protect us through all of these because he's sovereign over nature, he's sovereign over people, and he loves us. He gives us the encouragement we need as we face threats. So we must trust him as we keep on following him and seeking to serve Jesus Christ, not letting any fears keep us from going where he leads and doing as he directs. The cause and glory of Christ are worthy of our full obedience. The sovereign care of our God is worthy of our complete trust. Will you pray with me? Our Father, please help us to obey your word and not to fear. Not to be anxious, but to trust you. You can, you do, sovereignly care for us, providing for our needs, protecting us from danger, even as you sometimes lead us through storms and wrecks and natural threats. We have no doubt of your power to care for us. Please help us not to doubt your interest in caring for us. Please do meet our needs as we seek to follow you, your direction for us, and to serve Jesus by speaking of him wherever we can. Please keep us devoted to that cause. Please cause us to be confident in your care. Please keep your word on our hearts for these purposes, and may your Spirit use it in us to increase that trust and to deepen that devotion. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.